This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Franz at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we are pleased to have here in the studio with us our chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser. And he is here so that we can talk a little bit about weather. I'm sure that we'll be talking about severe thunderstorms and tornadoes, especially. It is that time of year when we're starting to try to remind people that it's not going to be all that long before we get into severe spring and early summer weather. And of course, as he has taught us, let's remember that you can actually have a tornado any month of the year, and we have in Illinois. And in every month, there have been tornadoes. But they're a little bit less common in the months of November, December, January, February. But once you get into the spring, we're going to start to have some more severe weather. And last week, if you were listening, you know that we were trying to remind people to pay attention to the weather. If there are warnings, to seek shelter and things that you can do to try to make sure that you're safe. And maybe we can remind you again, hit on some of those basic things again here this morning. But it's also an opportunity for people who are listening to call in and ask questions about weather, about how weather works, about forecasters, how they track it. And every once in a while, Ed has been good enough to come here and be on the program so we can answer some of these kinds of questions that take a little bit more time to go into. Sometimes people want to try to ask them when we do the talk tos, and we have to say, no, sorry, we can't do that. But on a show like this, we certainly can. So, any and all questions about weather and how it works and how forecasters do what they do, you can call us. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being
here. It's good to be here.
Maybe we should also tell people that if they were thinking about this, wondering about this, I was too. Yes, indeed, there will be a tornado show this year, and it will be 1 month from today, right, at Beckman.
Yep, April 12th. That's a Thursday evening, 7 p.m. at the Beckman Institute Auditorium. And we've had it there the last several years. And look forward to working with the Beckman Institute again this year.
Yeah, it's a nice nice place. It's a good setting. It's a nice auditorium that they have. But it's not very big, so probably people should, if they really want to get a good seat, they probably want to try and get there early.
That would be the advice. I think this year they're opening up a room across the hall with closed-circuit TV, I think. I think we are making some contingencies in case we get overcrowded this year. Every year is a little different, but the last couple of years we were full. So it's advisable to come a little early to get the best seat.
Yeah, and it's a good show, and if you're interested, and Ed always has, for years and years, has accumulated all the various kinds of tornado videos that he could possibly get his hands on so that people could see some of the things that we're talking about.
And the show is free, although occasionally Jay Pierce does do a little pledge break there. But we're just so used to doing that everywhere we go. But it is a free show.
Go in pledge mode at the blink of an eye. Well, we have a caller here. Let's go ahead and talk with them. We'll not make them wait. Someone who is in Champaign. This is line one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I got a question. I do not have a basement, so my three choices are a bathroom with a cast iron tub fed by copper lines, or a hallway with lots of books, or a kind of a sunken garage that I could sit in the car with. What's my best answer?
Does your bathroom, is it in the middle of the house?
Well, it's kind of on an end, but the bathtub's kind of near the center.
Because a lot of times the bathrooms seem to hold up better than other rooms in a house when tornado winds have hit it. So a good sturdy bathroom or bathtub bolted down by a strong pipe is probably a good place. Of course, you want to cover yourself if you use the bathtub.
Well, how about, if lightning would strike me sitting in a cast iron bathtub?
Well, that's a possibility. So I guess what I tell people, if you're in a situation where a tornado is bearing down on you, you just go where you think is best for that. But certainly you don't want to be in a cast iron bathtub most of the time around a thunderstorm. And tornadoes are produced by thunderstorms. I'm always a little concerned about the garage. The garage is a little bit more open, a little bigger. the garage door tends to blow in more easily than some other parts of the house, so that opens the door to more debris and the roof caving in. Of course, every building that's hit by a tornado behaves a little differently just based on how the tornado hits it, but I would probably opt for the center hallway in the house over the garage if you don't feel comfortable with the bathtub.
Well, would you feel comfortable on a cast iron bathtub in the storm?
Well, usually no, I wouldn't, but if I felt that was the best place I could survive a tornado, I'd go there over any other place in the house. But
well, we can go either way. They're only about 10 feet apart, so I was wondering.
Well, that part of the house will probably hold up better than other parts of the house based on damage we've looked at over the years. But bottom line is you want to get to the lowest floor possible, and for you that's the first floor, and you want to put as many walls between you and the outside as possible. You want to avoid the debris flying around, and I would also keep some blankets and pillows nearby. Cover yourself in those. That way you're at least protected from some flying glass and other objects going through the air.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
Best of luck.
And that's I think that's an important point. I think we've tried to make that over and over again, that in fact that when people are killed, they're killed by flying debris. So what you want, that's why the advice is you want to stay away from windows. And it's probably a good idea if you have something that you can cover yourself with. That's a good thing to do that, too.
Well, we always say, because you're never in the same place all the time, that you want to get in a sturdy building, you want to go to the lowest floor in that building, whatever it happens to be, and you want to put as many walls between you and the outside as possible. Now, for your home, you probably want to take a little extra care and find that place you would go to in an instant, and that place you might want to keep some protection there. Mm-hmm. Even blankets and pillows help. I know a lot of people that have survived tornadoes say, you may not think about this, but you want to keep a pair of shoes there. Because if your house is hit, when I've talked to people that have been in homes that are hit, a lot of times they're just wearing socks and not shoes, and then they wish they had the shoes after they were hit. And some people also leave some of their photographs there. That's one thing that's probably lost more than anything in a tornado that people are most concerned about later. It's not the furniture and all the worldly possessions you lose, but the memories, the things that are most important to you. So that's something else you might want to keep. Even you, the really precious pictures you want to probably protect from fire as well. But those are things that people that have lived through tornadoes have told me, shoes and pictures, believe it or not.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Let's go to next, someone in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Yes. I know it's usually not a good idea to be in a car, and you're usually not too fond of garages, but how would it be to be in a car in the garage? That would seem to give you some protection from falling debris, and the car wouldn't seem as vulnerable as it would be outside.
Well, that's not my... there's some people that have recommended that, but based on what I've seen, a lot of garages collapse, and a lot of the garage doors are a place where wind can come in and lift the roof up, and then sometimes everything comes crashing down on the car. You're probably not going to be tossed around in the car that's in a garage as opposed to if you were out on a highway, but you do run the risk of being crushed in that car. So it's still not really advised to do that.
Well, that was just a thought.
Well, some have had that thought, but I guess what really makes me leery about that is just seeing how many garages have been damaged in tornadoes compared to other parts of houses.
They're usually not as substantially built as the rest of the house. And it would also make some difference, I would think, whether it was on the west or the east side of the house.
Well, sometimes, though, with the rotating winds, that can't always be... The tornadoes just do freaky things. Sometimes you have the tornado within a tornado, too. So I don't think there's one side that you can guarantee is safe compared to another.
Well, I guess I'll still head for the basement.
That's a good place, under something sturdy.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank
you. Excellent. Let's go to Chicago, line number four, for another caller. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know A little more about the humidity, outside, inside, and how is that measured? On a foggy day, they say the humidity is 100. Is that right?
Well, the first thing, it's good that you bring that up. Whenever there's a percent number given, it's actually the relative humidity. And when the relative humidity is 100%, that means the air is saturated. And what that means is the amount of water vapor, that's H2O in the gas form, in the air is at its maximum possible at a given temperature. Now, that maximum possible goes up as temperature goes up. So that's why we call it relative humidity. It's the humidity relative to the temperature. So when the relative humidity is 100%, the air is saturated and you tend to get fog to form. Unfortunately, there's no common measures of actual humidity that are given anywhere, really, newspapers, broadcasts, or elsewhere. The closest we come to that is the dew point temperature. The dew point temperature goes up as humidity goes up, and it goes down as humidity goes down. So in the summertime, we emphasize the dew point temperature a lot because a lot of people have become accustomed to what that means. And usually what we like to say is when the dew point temperature is 65 degrees Fahrenheit or higher, we say it's humid. When it gets above 70, it's really humid. And when it's 75 or higher, it's oppressive. And that's when it's really, really nasty. And the dew point temperature will not exceed the temperature. So the dew point's always low in the winter because the temperature's low. And that means the humidity's low. So you come out to a point in winter oftentimes where the humidity is low, but the relative humidity can be high.
What is the comfortable humidity indoors in the wintertime? I hear 40.
Probably 35-40%. That's usually comfortable. And the reason it's so low in winter is because there isn't much humidity outside because it is cold. So if you have a dew point temperature of, say, 20 degrees, the temperature's 30 degrees, you'll probably have a relative humidity somewhere around 60% outside, but you bring that in and heat the air, you're going to have no change in humidity, but the temperature goes way up, so your relative humidity goes below 10%. And that's why a lot of people get humidifiers in the winter to actually add humidity to the air.
Do they work in a central heating, but in an apartment where you don't have that? Does anybody make one that really works? And are they safe, as far as moisture and bacteria forming?
Well, I'm not the expert on that. I know some humidifiers do work, but as with anything else, you'd probably want to check with check reviews of them because I'm sure some work better than others. And as far as the issue, you're right. You want to keep it clean because that is something that if you have a dirty system, that can pollute the air in your home. But humidifiers do add moisture in the air, which is beneficial because otherwise we just dry up in the middle of winter, and a lot of people have problems with dry and cracking skin, and
that's
because the humidity levels are so low when it's cold out.
Does anybody make a gauge that's accurate or that you can trust to measure the humidity indoors?
Well, the relative humidity you can measure indoors with an instrument. A lot of weather instrument companies, which I don't have any specific recommendations on. You could check on the internet, but they do a decent job of measuring the indoor relative humidity. So again, if you keep it around 30-40%, you're probably comfortable in the winter time. A little higher in the summer, but in the summer, of course, then you have the other problem with too much humidity, and a dehumidifier is good, but a lot of that's already factored in with air conditioning.
I have friends that came to Chicago from Florida, and they don't like the dryness up here. They're more used to the moisture, humidity down there, and they complain it's too dry and they're uncomfortable. So I said, well, you got to get some kind of a device to put more moisture in the air, but that doesn't appeal to people. So.
Well, I know down in Florida, they have higher humidity year-round. Our humidity actually isn't much different than Florida's humidity in the middle of summer heat waves, but otherwise we are drier.
in Chicago, one station, now and then they'll give the humidity, but they give the water temperature in the lake all the time. Well, what? Who cares about the lake water is 35 degrees? I don't know why they throw that in.
Well, I could tell you the lake temperature does make a difference with the weather, for example. I actually, as a meteorologist, forecasting the weather for Chicago, the lake temperature is very important. You get what's called a lake breeze in the springtime when there's light wind, and the air over Lake Michigan is much colder when the water temperature is 35. So some of that cold air will start to blow in on what we call a lake breeze in the midday and afternoon hours and keep the loop a lot colder than the western suburbs. And on the opposite side, the water temperature usually doesn't cool as quickly in the fall, so that moderates coastal areas. And also the lake water temperature is important to us in the fall when we're talking about lake effect snow, because the bigger difference in temperature between what's right above the lake and the colder air above, the greater the likelihood of lake effect snow squalls forming. So that's important for some people. And also, of course, once you get into the recreational boating season, people want to know how warm the lake is for swimming. Yeah. And it's often not until mid to late summer that it's near comfortable for swimming.
All right. Well, I want to thank the caller. We got somebody else here. I just want to introduce again our guest, Ed Kieser. He's our chief meteorologist for WILO. And we're talking about weather. Part of what we wanted to hear is talk a little bit about severe storms, severe thunderstorms and tornadoes, because we are heading into the time of year where we're going to start to see more of them. But if you have other questions about weather and weather forecasting, I know Ed will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Because next caller, this here's line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, Ed.
Hi.
I've always wanted to talk to you, but I never get through. This is my big chance. I'm getting ready to move to Terre Haute, Illinois, or Terre Haute, Indiana. Do they get a lot of tornadoes too?
Well, I'd say probably there's probably not an appreciable difference in the odds of getting a tornado in Terre Haute than Saybrook. I do know that there might be a slight tilt in the odds of Saybrook being a little bit more tornado prone than Terre Haute, but not by very much. There's not an appreciable difference. So you still have to be concerned and pay attention to the weather there.
And my thing has always been go to the water heater, the hot water heater, because I used to live in Ogden.
Oh, were you there in 96?
I was. And when I walked around, I actually wasn't there when the tornado went through, but when I went back to get my stuff, what was left, all that was left was fireplaces and hot water heaters. And that made a believer out of me. I thought to myself, well, if I have a fireplace, I'm going to climb in it, or I'm going to chain myself to a hot water heater.
Well, the one thing I'd be concerned about with the fireplace is a lot of them are made of bricks, and you may have some bricks fall off the top and come down and hit you. So the fireplace may be standing, but you still might be at risk of being hit by something. As far as a hot water heater, I don't know if I'd chain myself to it, but a lot of times the bathroom area and the areas of the house that have the most plumbing hold together a little better than other parts of the house. So so there is something to that. Of course, if you have a basement, go there, get under something sturdy.
And I have a crawl. The new house has a crawl space.
There's some debate on that, because sometimes the if a tornado is strong enough, it might just knock the whole thing down. If I got in a crawl space, I would get near where there may be the plumbing again, where there's lots of support in a small area. I wouldn't just get under a large span of the crawl space, because if that could collapse a little easier.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much, Ed.
Good luck.
Good luck.
Let's go on here.
And good luck with your move, too.
You certainly wouldn't. I wouldn't want to get into a space that might be difficult to get out of. again. You'd want to make it to be secure, but you also, I think, once the tornado is passed, you want to be able to get out.
You do indeed want to be able to get out. That's for sure. And with the crawl space, that's an interesting question, because there are some situations where the house is sunk down a little bit, it's pushed off the foundation, and you could get crushed in the crawl space. That's why I say if you do go there, you will want to make sure you're in an area that you can't not only get out of, but also you have a lot of support near where you are.
Yeah. Okay.
But I know that there are some safety experts that say you're better off on the first floor than a crawl space. I think you have to evaluate each home individually, too, and just look at the situation.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk with somebody in Lovington next, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Last spring, there was a tornado watch that came out about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. As I remember, it went from about Bloomington most of the way down. And I listened to the farm program at 2, and Mr. Hilberg was on at 2:30, and Todd Gleason, or whichever it was, asked him about this, what was going to happen around here, and he said, well, I think that what's going to happen is the temperature will go down about 10 degrees in 10 minutes, but the severe stuff will stay south and east of here, which is exactly what happened. And I was wondering, how did he know that?
How did he know that? Well, he was looking at the latest observations from airports and looking at the radar and piecing it all together, and sometimes the watches... Well, oftentimes when a watch is issued, it's issued for a large area, and then as the storms come through, counties are canceled. Sometimes the cancellations don't come as quickly as we think they should. We just relay the official watches and warnings, but sometimes add our own commentary when we think maybe there's a little bit of a lag there. But he was able to look at some raw data and follow the situation and be able to say once this front goes through, the temperature will drop and then the severe weather threat will be to the south.
So he was looking at the narrower picture than whichever agency it is that issues these watches looking at.
Well, the watches are issued by the National Weather Service's Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma, but the cancellations are county by county are done by the local office, which for us is out of Lincoln, Illinois. So really, they're looking at things on a narrower focus, but oftentimes they err on the side of caution and don't cancel immediately.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Maybe it'd be worth taking a second here to again remind people about the meaning of the watch and the warning. I think as many times as we have done this, people are still confused about what the difference is between those two things.
And that's because they both start with W, and some genius came up with that back in the 1960s, and it's not very easy to change things, so we'll just... tell you what it's all about. A tornado watch indicates tornadoes and or severe thunderstorms are possible. And when a tornado watch is issued, you should review tornado safety rules, monitor local weather closely, and seek alternative shelter if you live in a mobile home. Now, if you're living in or are in a sturdy building, just know where to go in that building. And when we say monitor the weather, there's two things you should be doing there. You should be actually watching the sky, because sometimes storms come up rather quickly and you won't get the warning. And also pay attention to WILL, your NOAA All Hazards Weather Radio, and keep up to date with where the storms are.
Okay.
And a warning.
When the warning comes, that means the tornado has been, a tornado has been spotted, and this really says there is a tornado, somebody has seen it, it's coming your way, so you take cover right now.
Well, usually it means somebody's seen it. It's an urgent message that a tornado has been sighted or detected by Doppler radar. Sometimes the warning is issued before the tornado actually touches down if the Doppler radar is showing the strong rotation in the storm. And when a warning is issued for your area, you should move quickly to a place of safety and take cover. Now, over the next year, the warnings are going to change a little bit. The National Weather Service is trying to hone in more on the areas threatened, which means smaller areas under warnings. But that also probably means more frequent warnings issued, meaning we're going to be interrupting broadcast even more for these more precise warnings. So they're going to what's called storm-based warnings instead of county-based warnings. And one thing that we're doing is we're listing towns in the path of the storm. That's always a little tricky because where's the cutoff on a town being big enough to be listed? A lot of that depends on also how many other bigger towns are around. So if you hear your town or one nearby, or if you're in between two towns listed, you're in the warning. That's a way to follow that. But instead of issuing a tornado warning for all of Champaign County, which is a big county, maybe the northern, the central, or southern part. Now, I know a lot of people don't know exactly where they live, so that's why the towns are going to be listed as well.
Okay. So that also suggests to me that from now, we always would have wanted people to take the warning seriously, but now it's probably you should even take them more seriously if it's being now even more specific, that they're trying to say, even limiting the geographic area the warning is for. So to me, that would say now you're in it. If there's a warning, you're in it.
But there are times where, say, Philo and Sydney might be in a tornado warning and Champaign-Urbana will not. Or Rantoul might be in a tornado warning and Sydney and Philo will not be. And there's still going to be times that there's a line of storms that the whole county will be put under a warning. But more often now it's going to be just portions of the county and maybe for a little bit shorter duration. So that means as the storm moves, more warnings will be issued. And that's why for us, it may seem like there's a lot more warnings. But in actuality, less areas will be under a warning at any given time.
Okay. Well, our guest this morning is our chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser. We're talking about getting ready for severe weather, thunderstorms, tornadoes. And if you have more general kind of weather questions, you can call. I know he'll do his best, try to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have some other callers. The next is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Maybe we could get it down to zip code, you know, maybe years from now. Why is it, I'm in, southwest Champaign, and the Interstate 57, sometimes, you know, in terms of snowstorms and things of that nature, I'm not even sure in terms of other storms, but why do they use that? Usually they say maybe west of there. I'm sorry. Yeah, it'd be west of there. But a lot of times, and it's the same way the interstate goes east and west, you know, north of Champaign. Sometimes it's north there. It just is that the flow or what happens there?
It's, well, to describe things on the radio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's more or less you have to pick landmarks that are known by many people. And if the storms are all west of I-57, that's one thing you can say to help describe to the public. So it's not a magical boundary. And usually when we're talking about storms are west of I-57, they're not there forever. But once they come east, then can't use that description anymore. A lot of times when storms are in western Illinois, a description might be they're all still west of the Illinois River. Or in the case of a snowstorm, there was one earlier in the year where we said heaviest snow will be west of the Illinois River, and that's where it was. And basically west of Peoria and Havana, that's where over a foot of snow fell. I think that was right around the beginning of December. We had some ice here, and that was the bad ice storm in Decatur and Springfield. So it's really hard to describe the weather when you're in the flatlands of Illinois. You have to come up with some descriptors. Unfortunately, the roads don't always go the direction I'd like to have them go to be able to describe things. I'd love to have a nice grid of east-west and north-south roads. And as you probably know, I-57 curves toward the northeast, and I-55 is even more so southwest to northeast once you get north of Bloomington. So sometimes those roads work good as descriptors, sometimes they don't. But that's why we use them. It's just more people know those highways and even county boundaries.
Yeah, the other one is that I would assume that in my place, You talked me out of going under the house. I have a large clothes closet, and it's, you know, interior. So my hallway is open sort of on the other end, which I don't think would be a great spot to be. So I would assume that would be a good area to go to. Actually, last year I was driving that shear. What is that called, a wind shear? Is that what that's called or not?
Well, there is wind shear, downburst, sure.
Well, that was that one that took off some of the bricks and everything downtown Champaign.
Okay, that was strong straight-line winds. That was not a tornado in downtown Champaign. That was a more widespread downburst.
Well, that was scary, because I was in the car on the way home, and I was dodging limbs and all kinds of things. So it would have been better off if it had happened, if I was not in the midst of it, would have been better off to stay downtown, actually, in a more, I would assume, a more secure building, because it wasn't great to be out.
Well, as you probably noted, there probably you're most fearful of something hitting you, something flying through the air. So that's why buildings are better than being outside when strong winds hit.
Well, the other one, you know, you're dodging trees, you know, limbs, yeah, all that kind of stuff. And a lot of the lights were out in Southwest Champaign at that point, too. So you do a great program. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling. And just to note, yeah, I think the large closet is probably, interior is probably better than the hallway, because you have less chance of things flying around. Of course, get under something sturdy in the closet if you can, so you don't have everything in the top part of the closet falling on you. But
and it's probably good also to remind people that that with severe thunderstorms, you can have very strong winds, and that can also, they can be dangerous and they can be very damaging. So you can have very high winds without having a tornado.
And some of the wind speeds are higher than those of your average weak tornado. Damaging thunderstorm winds sometimes exceed 100 miles per hour and cover a larger area too. And we did experience that in Champaign-Urbana last year on April 2nd.
Yeah. So also people should keep in mind that we do, in addition to doing the tornado watches and warnings, we do watches and warnings for severe thunderstorms. And that's something that they ought to be, you ought to be just as, if we give you a severe thunderstorm warning, you ought to be just as concerned about that as by a tornado.
A severe thunderstorm warning means you could have really strong winds, over 58 mile per hour wind gust, and or large hail, 3/4 of an inch in diameter or larger.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Let's talk with someone in Urbana. Line 2. Hello.
Hi. Hearing you talk about these straight-line winds reminds me of, it was, I don't think there was, I know there wasn't a tornado warning. I'd just gotten into bed, so it was, I don't know, 10, 11 o'clock at night, and I suddenly heard what sounded like a railroad train coming. And I just about got my feet on the floor, and then it was gone. And the next morning, something had come through. It took out the flagpole next door, picked up a canoe and moved it about 20 feet, took off the tops of the trees, kind of in a diagonal line in our neighborhood. And it apparently wasn't a tornado, but a straight line wind. So, you know, you're right. We should pay attention to these things. I forget if there was a severe thunderstorm warning, but it was intriguing that I could, it sounded to me like what has been described as a tornado sound, like a railroad train coming.
Well, it doesn't surprise me, because if you have a wind speed of 80, 90, 100 miles per hour, that's going to cause quite a roar. And it sounds to me like a downburst, and that's just some downward flowing air out of the thunderstorm in a concentrated fashion hitting the ground and then spreading forward as the storm moves through. So you could have damage equal to your average tornado, and an average tornado really isn't that strong. Wind speed's probably around 100 miles per hour for an average tornado.
It was very limited and very much in a straight line, so it was, you know, it wasn't a big widespread thing. Listening to you, I'm thinking that one of the things we should all have is a map of Illinois, or if you're in Indiana, a map of Indiana, so that you can look and see where these towns are, get an idea of where the tornado is tracking. You know, when bad weather is on, I have the radio on. I have the radio on most of the time anyway, but I can't always pay full attention to it. I do remember listening to you when the tornado came, was 96, you said, through Urbana and over to Ogden, and I could tell by your voice that we were in for trouble. And I listened to you all day, and you got more and more worried. And it was really useful to have you commenting on how things were developing. But, you know, we can't always do that, depending on what people are doing. And I think if we all had some idea where these towns were, we might have some idea of how the storm was tracking, so we had some idea how closely to pay attention. I'm thinking, too, about our programmable weather alert radio. And you said that they're going from a county warning system to a town warning system. Does that affect the programming that I've got?
Not yet.
Have in the radio? Because I have it. What I did was I programmed Piatt and I think Piatt and Champaign County. So I figured things tend to come from the southwest toward Urbana.
Well, as far as that, no, it's not going to change the weather radio yet. If you have Piatt and Champaign counties programmed in, any time a warning's issued for any part of those counties, it'll go off. And I know they're thinking about in the future being more precise with the weather radio, but right now the technology isn't really there. There are codes developed to break each county down into 9 sectors, northwest, north central, northeast, and so on. But as far as I know, for the next few years, the National Weather Service isn't going to be able to utilize that. So your weather radio will still work. It will probably go off for a little more than you might want. If, say, there's a storm in Rantoul and you live in Champaign, Urbana, it'll go off just as it always has, but only for whatever county you have programmed in there. If there's any warning or watch for any part of that county, it'll go off. Otherwise, it won't.
And what I'm also hearing you say is that, or extrapolating, is that you can't necessarily expect to hear the final, this is really it, because the this is really it may not be seen. Is that correct? I mean, the tornado may suddenly come. I mean, they may expect rotation, but they may not see tornadoes, et cetera. And so I've already forgotten the difference between a watch and a warning. Dang it. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Right, yeah. Well, anyway, sometimes a warning will not be issued until a tornado is sighted, and that's after it's touched down. Usually with the bigger storms, you see it coming for a while, and the rotation's more pronounced on the radar. But some of the weak and middle-grade tornadoes aren't always detected by radar well in advance. So we still have to have storm spotters out there, and when one is seen, they issue the warning. But if it happens to come down on your house, you may not have the warning. So that's why everybody still has to pay attention to the weather when it's threatening.
Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Right, thank you. Let's go to Charleston. This is line 4. Hello.
I'm wondering if the St. Louis urban heat island could decrease rainfall as far away as here in Charleston.
I don't think so, really. The urban heat island situation, it's puzzling to me sometimes it's puzzling to me when a lot of people say, oh, the urban heat island cuts down on rainfall. I would think you almost have the opposite. Warm air arises and you have a better chance of convection. And so I think sometimes that's a myth. And certainly as far away as Charleston, I don't think there's really a St. Louis effect on Charleston weather. And of course, if there was, that would only be when the winds up at storm level were coming directly from that area anyway, and a lot of times it's not exactly from St. Louis, so I would say no.
Well, the reason I'm asking is I like to look at the precipitation map that's on the U of I weather website, and quite often what I see is there's a dry streak that starts at St. Louis and stretches up past here in Charleston. Effingham will get a lot of rain, Champaign will get a lot of rain, and we'll get nothing. So I was just noting a correlation.
Well, I think if you look at it over a long period of time, it more evens out. Every storm is different, and I know in Champaign-Urbana, a lot of folks tell me all the storms miss here.
And sometimes
they do. Yet people outside of Champaign-Urbana say, boy, you always get the storms. So a lot of it is probably perception. And sometimes you'll get a persistent period of where the same thing happens over and over for a month or two, and that helps grow the perception. But a lot of it is perception, I think. Over the long haul, I doubt that there – I've not seen any evidence of a dry streak over the long haul, maybe over the short term. Certainly over the short term, you do get areas that are wetter and drier than elsewhere. But over the long haul, that hasn't really shown up on anything I've seen.
Is there a place on the web where there's an archive of these precipitation maps so that I could get a better feeling for it?
I don't think there's a really good archive. Maybe the place to start would be to ask the Midwestern Regional Climate Center, and the contact information for them can be found on the web. Their address, if you have something to write down, there's no www. It's just MCC, for Midwestern Climate Center, .SWS, which is State Water Survey, .UIUC.edu. Again,
right.
That's mcc.sws.uiuc.edu, and they have a large archive of data. Some, I don't know if they have that available easily, but you could ask, and they would know where you could go.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Good luck
and,
with that.
I know that people have, I think maybe semi-jokingly, talked about urban heat island effect for Champaign-Urbana, saying that you can watch storms, they head this way, and then they just go right around us.
Sometimes with weak storms in cities, I do think there maybe is a friction effect with the more of the buildings and all that's there, but that's mm-hmm. only for weak storms. When you have a strong thunderstorm coming through, the city isn't really going to affect it, and I think that leads into the myth that a tornado is not going to strike the city I'm in. I'm protected. I'm in the city. And that's just not true. And over the last several years, we've seen several cities or parts of cities get hit by tornadoes. Cities are big enough. A tornado is not going to wipe out a whole city in one fell swoop. But we've seen tornadoes hit cities, mm-hmm. and it does happen, and especially when you get the strong and violent tornadoes, you're not protected being in a city at all, and urban heat island effect or even friction are not going to knock apart a strong or violent thunderstorm.
Okay, I'm stuck with line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was hearing your first caller, I believe, ask something about this bathroom safety in the bathtub, and I assume it was electrical grounding as part of that concern. I was just wondering if Ed might think that Scott Spees would be a good resource person to check with about that sort of concern.
I don't know. If you're concerned about electrical grounding, you could talk to a home inspection type person. The caller that was really concerned had a cast iron bathtub. So you're looking at a situation where it's a little more vulnerable than your average bathtub, because cast iron being metal, if the pipes get struck by lightning, the whole bathtub could be electrified. The odds of that happening in any particular place at a particular time are small, but you still don't want to be putting yourself to that chance. I would say if that's the safest place in your house with a tornado bearing down, you just have to make the decision to use that over something else. But most bathtubs, I think, are you don't want to – the problem with taking a shower or a bath in a lightning storm is if the electrical charge comes down the pipes, it will electrify the water, because water is a good conductor of electricity. But if you keep the bathtub dry, there really shouldn't be that much of a problem.
Yeah, and certainly if the bathtub is plastic, as most of the bathtubs, a lot of bathtubs are now, you wouldn't have that kind of concern that you would. I mean, I live in an old house, and we also have a cast iron bathtub. So I guess that's I never.
So
really,
you worried
never
about
really
that?
Thought about, I never really thought about it. I mean, I know the basic advice about how you're not, if there's an electrical storm going on, you don't want to be taking a bath at that moment. But I guess I didn't really think about just getting into the tub as a way of trying to find protection. I guess in our house we would still go to the basement. So the bathroom is on the second
basement?
Floor. I wouldn't.
No.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be hanging around in the bathroom. Well, I think that's probably about the best answer we can give to that caller right at the moment. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Bloomington. This is line number three. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was interested in what methodology is used to calculate the percent
chance of precipitation on any gave. If it's going to be 30% chance for rain tomorrow, you know, what is factored into that? And I'll just hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. First of all, I don't use percent chances in my forecast because it just causes more confusion than it's worth. So what I do is I just try to best describe what I think is going to happen. But as far as a percent chance of precipitation, the official way of determining that is trying to determine what chance there is in a similar, based on similar weather patterns in the past, that you will get a hundredth of an inch of precipitation at your location. So let's say in a similar situation, 3 out of 10 times it rained enough to get a hundredth of an inch of precipitation, then that would be a 30% chance of rain. And that is technically how it's supposed to be calculated. I don't think sometimes forecasters put a lot of methodology into it. I think they just come up with a number and say, well, it's 30% or 40, or they use whatever the computer model output says. And the bottom line is, if you say 30% chance of rain, you're wrong. It's either going to be 100 or zero. That's one of the other reasons why I don't like to use it. Oftentimes when there's a 30% chance of rain, there are showers and thunderstorms in the area. So it just is a matter of chance whether they go right over your location or not. But a 30% chance of rain means there's a 3 in 10 chance that you, at your location, will get a hundredth of an inch of precipitation. It has nothing to do with the coverage of rainfall. It has nothing to do with whether there's a trace of rainfall or not, because a trace doesn't count. It has to be measurable to count as being 100 versus zero in the verification. So percents are helpful, I think, for a lot of parameters, especially if you're looking at long-term odds on something. You might tilt the odds one way or another and make purchasing of, say, fuel for heating or cooling if you're in the industry, or trying to figure out what to plant as a farmer. But you don't ever put all your eggs in one basket in the long range, because nobody knows for sure what's going to happen. So you might use percentages to tilt your odds a little bit. But I think for day-to-day living, a lot of times the percentages just add confusion to what you hear on the radio. It's more numbers. That's the other thing. On the radio, I'm sensitive to the fact we're already giving lots of numbers and don't want to add even more. So we just don't give them here.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like if you were looking at the forecast that's issued by the National Weather Service. That's the one, for example, if you're watching the Weather Channel on the 8th, that's the forecast.
Although they make their own now.
Oh, really?
The Weather Channel doesn't use the National Weather Service. They have a computer making their own forecast.
Well, they do give those percentages in their forecast. And obviously, you know, even it's possible that if we'd say, you know, for your location, there's even only a 5% chance of rain. Well, it could rain.
It could rain.
It could rain. But it sounds like as if, for example, if it's a 30% chance of rain, it sounds like the chances of raining where you are actually pretty low. That once you, if it's maybe it's a 70 or 80%, if what you want to know is, okay, should I take my umbrella? Is it going to rain on me? That once you get 30%, you know, that's pretty low. Once you get maybe 70, 80%, then at least it seems much more likely that yes, rain will fall on your head at that percentage, as opposed to say if it's even if it's a 30% chance of rain. That's actually on the low
side.
Although
you can really get nailed with that 30%, because in the summertime, a lot of times when we have the convective pop-up thunderstorms in the afternoon, oftentimes the forecast from the National Weather Service or the Weather Channel say 30% chance of thunderstorms. And then it's a case of, is that thunderstorm going to hit your location or not? As they pop up, and you'll know you can get a lot of rain. And if you're under one, you're drenched.
Yeah.
So knowing the nature of the weather, I think, is and that's what we try to do is describe it. I know in the limited time we have, we're not always as precise as we'd like to be. And sometimes the weather's hard to be precise in forecasting. Other times we can be very precise. And hopefully that, too, helps listeners gauge whether it's a sure thing or not, because sometimes it is a sure thing, and we're able to say this is what's going to happen. Other times, we have to use a few descriptive adjectives to convey a little bit of the uncertainty.
Okay. Well, one more time, let's remind people that if they're interested in seeing some tornado video and hearing out some other things about the weather, Ed will once again be doing the tornado show this year. There'll be one show, 1 month from today, at 7 o'clock in the evening at the auditorium at the Beckman Institute on North Matthews. And there is free parking available in the garage that's at the corner of University and Matthews. So if you're concerned about parking, you can do that. And again, if you want to get a good seat, it's probably a good idea to try to be there earlier rather than later, because the auditorium itself is, I don't know, how many people does that?
It's over 200, but I don't know the exact number.
Okay.
I just show up. I also want to say next Tuesday, March 20th, in the 1 o'clock hour, we're going to be doing Sky Guys. Dave Leake
great.
From the Starkle Planetarium
great.
Will be joining me then. So, well, we can take your astronomy questions then, too.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Ed Kieser, our chief meteorologist.